thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I'm thinking...
Here's John Williams.
They could make a movie out of one of our guests today. I'll bet you, in fact, I'll ask him if the work, if the plans are in the works. I'll bet you he's going to say... I bet he's going to say yes. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3, Saturdays, 10 a.m. till noon. Like me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram on all social media. I am WGN King John. Don't forget, we have a podcast called The Mincing Rascals that Steve Bertrand and I and friends of ours at the Chicago Tribune host. We talk about current events. You can hear that on Thursdays or virtually any time, but we drop new ones on Thursdays. We call it The Mincing Rascals. Patty Vasquez from pretty late here at WGN Radio. Weeknights joins us, too. By the way, that guest that I'm thinking about is a guy who was the wrangler. I was describing his job to Steve Bertrand just before the news. His name is Patrick Kinane. His book is called West Winging It, an unprecedented or unpresidential memoir. But it goes from him being an intern to him being a writer for Barack Obama and the guy that accompanied him for 6 years on presidential trips domestically, internationally. He wasn't a high-level aide. He wasn't a policy guy. He was a wrangler. He was a guy that would tell the media, okay, everybody over there and everybody over here. And his insight into the interaction between the Obamas, the president and his staff, and the president and the press is very interesting. You know, you can just see an almost Aaron Sorkin-like script where the wrangler is the focus. And so you sort of get his life as he's dealing with the minutiae of a presidency, but also with the grandeur of the presidency, too. I don't know. I'll ask him if they're going to make a movie about it. We'll talk about his book. That's 1 hour from now at 2:05 here on WGN. It's 1:11. We're all trying to comprehend the Kate Spade story. I'm reading from the New York Times. Miss Spade built a brand on the appeal of clothes and accessories that made women smile. Her cheerful lack of restraint and bright prints striking a chord with consumers. A housekeeper found Miss Spade hanged. The police said she was unconscious. Miss Spade's husband was at the scene. A police spokesperson did not know the whereabouts of her 13-year-old daughter. With a red scarf, they say, she hanged herself from a doorknob. I have read that sentence more than once and don't know exactly how she was able to take her own life, but something along that manner happened. She had been the accessories editor of Mademoiselle magazine, founded Kate Spade with her husband-to-be, Andy, and a friend, Elise Ahrens, in 1993. Only 1993. I mean, it strikes me as a company relatively new for as successful as it was. What was it? The company was purchased along with one other company for $3 billion. For more than a decade, Kate Spade had not been directly involved in the running of the brand Kate Spade. She did not know what to call the company at first and decided to make it a combination of the names of the co-founders. After the first show, she realized that the bags needed a little something extra to catch people's eyes, the New York Times writes. She took the label, which originally had been on the inside of the bag, and sewed it to the outside with that gesture. She created a brand identity and her empire. Although it didn't take off, in fact, she and her husband had gone through their 401k, their life savings. They were having dinner one night at a Mexican restaurant. She was talking about her frustration with where her career was going and with bags and accessories and fashion. She saw the next job on her career chart as being an editor whose position she really didn't aspire to. And her husband said, well, why don't you just make your own company? And she laughed and she said, I don't know that it's that simple. And he said, really? Maybe it is. And she wanted to do some handbags that were a little more square, a little more geometric, a little more simple, a little more functional, a little more classic. I'm just reading some of the words or recollecting the ones that she used to describe her products, but more modern. And so they started cranking them out. And they were about ready to call it quits before they finally turned the tide. They were out of money. You know, you see these success stories and you go, well, sure, how could Kate Spade fail? But they were ready to call it quits because they just weren't able to at least at first, make a profit or see how they were ever going to make a profit. And then obviously they did. I've been reading the CNN queue or the list of stories about it. The company Kate Spade started, releases the first statement. We at Kate Spade New York just learned of the incredibly sad news that she has passed. Ivanka Trump has tweeted, "Kate Spade's tragic passing is a painful reminder that we never truly know another's pain or the burden they carry." That was my first reaction today. "If you're struggling with depression and contemplating suicide, please, please seek help," she wrote. And a lot of people are putting the suicide prevention hotline out there, 1-800-273-TALK, I believe it is. 1-800, there it is, 273-TALK. Plenty of people are saying, here's the number to call. "My grandmother gave me my first Kate Spade bag when I was in college. I still have it. Holding Kate's family, friends, and loved ones in my heart," Chelsea Clinton has tweeted today, too. "I suppose this story resonates more with women than it does with men. They probably are accustomed to the bags and the clothes and accessories and know her story better. Handbag giant Coach, there it is, first announced plans to buy the company last year with a $2.4 billion deal." So as a lot of people are saying, success doesn't make you happy. And my first thought about this story was that, you know, when we are mystified or angry at people who take their own lives, the level of success that she had, the life that she should have been able to enjoy, is evidence that these people are not in control of the events, even as they tie their own scarf around a doorknob. That's just the mystery and the madness of suicide. It's 1:15 on WGN. I was also intrigued by the Philadelphia Eagles story. I don't know what the solution is going forward. Maybe the solution is that we don't need to invite all of the NASCAR drivers and pro sports teams and college NCAA Division I winners to the White House because it's just so complicated these days. Now, maybe it'll be less complicated when we have a less divisive president someday. Maybe it'll go back to normal. But there was even a little bit of this when Barack Obama was president. Some of the athletes didn't agree with his policies and didn't want to go. But by and large, the team showed up. And the Philadelphia Eagles were ready to send 4 to 10 of the 88-person contingent. And so that's when the White House said, oh, just skip it. But as only the White House can, they had to put their own snarky and mean-spirited, I think, spin on it. Sarah Sanders said the vast majority of the Eagles, these are among Sarah Sanders' words. In other words, the vast majority of the Eagles team decided to abandon their fans. It's complicated for these guys. It's enough that they have decided not to go or that you've decided not to extend the invitation, to rescind it. Better that you all just go to your own corner. But that's never good enough for the Trump administration. So while the whole world will know this story and everybody will come to their own conclusions, they have to get in the last dig. She has to, at the end of a statement, say the vast majority of the Eagles teams decided to abandon their fans. Maybe the fans will be the deciders of that. I do seem to recall them having a parade after the Super Bowl, and the fans seem to be pretty happy with that. So I'm not sure this is the Eagles abandoning their fans. I think they abandoned a trip to the White House. I'm not sure what the solution to this sort of thing is going forward. Maybe you could help me with that. The president's going to call me later today and ask me for my views on this, and I'm not exactly sure what to tell him. But I'm leaning towards, you know what? You could just free up the schedule. You know, if the if the president happens to bump into the Super Bowl champions, they could, I don't know, have a soda. But maybe the ceremonial trudging off to the White House for the photo op, as harmless as that seems to be, at least right now is sufficiently complicated that we should just abandon the whole idea. The Trump administration, talk about blowing things up and draining the swamp. Maybe they should just say, you know what? Whoever wins the World Series this fall, we are preemptively announcing that we're going to sort of take that off your plate. You do not have to worry about who's going to come to the White House. Right? You know, we'll send somebody or the president will make a call to the coach or the team in the locker room afterwards. You know, we'll find a way to punch that ticket. But this whole conversation, which doesn't seem to be, you know, plowing any new ground. It's just everybody gets re-ticked at each other every season with every team. Maybe we don't need to do this anymore. That's where I'm sitting right now. If you've got a better solution, I'm interested in it. My number is 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Tell them about Amy Kite. All right. You know what we should do? We should ask Amy Kite. She seems to have her sort of finger on the pulse, at least real estate-wise. If you are contemplating selling your home, you may be worried that you cannot find the right moment to pull the trigger, and how much should you sell it for? Wouldn't it be great to work with an agent who has buyers lined up, literally going, Amy, get me a house, Amy, get me a house, and then your house comes on the market and she shows it to them? I'm recommending that you work with Amy Kite of Keller Williams Realty Infinity. With Amy, it's a conversation about your goals. How fast, how much, and if Amy doesn't sell it, you know, pick a date and dollar amount. If the home doesn't sell by the deadline, she's got a property management company, and you can rent the property if you want. And you're never obligated to stay with Amy. If she's not doing her job, tell her up the contract and walk away. A guy named Jason called Amy Kite. Amy tapped into her long list of qualified buyers who are just waiting for homes to come on the market. She works the eight counties of Chicagoland, remember? And within the first couple of days, she brought in multiple showings. They sold that home for over ask. Did it again. Call Amy Kite today, 847-877-9881, or online, amywillsellyourhome.com. I'll hit a button here while this next commercial plays. Tell me what your advice is to the sports teams or to the president. What are we going to do with these White House visits? This is on my Facebook page. This is a fourth grade boy. He had one of those little fourth grade talent shows. He stepped up to the piano. He's not much bigger than a microphone stand himself, this kid. So his mom took the video, she just posted it on Facebook, and now everybody is saying, thank you, kid. It's a really sweet performance. He did a really nice job. And then when he gets done, everybody cheers and applauds, and he puts one hand behind his waist and the other in front of it and does a perfect bow and then just marches off to the side. And the kids are going bananas. The person I feel sorry for is the next fourth grade kid, whose talent is 100 jumping jacks in 30 seconds, or whatever the heck their talent is. I mean, don't you? Every time you see one of these, you know, amazing, oh my God, that kid's amazing performances, you know, some other kid had to follow that act. And his mom's like, all right, great, great. I'll bet we're not going viral. Swell. But I kill you to let Timmy go first? Whatever. My wife Brenda said, I hope they put that kid last, because nobody wants to follow that. I'm reading the president's tweet. Here's your president. The Philadelphia Eagles team was invited to the White House. Unfortunately, only a small number of players decided to come, and we canceled the event. Staying in the locker room for the playing of our national anthem is as disrespectful to our country as kneeling. Sorry! Does that sound to you like the president decided to cancel it because they kneeled, and therefore, sorry, you don't get to go? That's so disrespectful, sorry. Because none of the Eagles players knelt during the 2017 regular season. One player knelt during the preseason, but he didn't even make the team. So, and they stood for the national anthem for the Super Bowl. So I'm not sure if the president's misinformed or he's just, you know, he's just spraying stuff here. He said, only a small number of players decided to come, and we canceled the event. Staying in the locker room for the playing of our national anthem is as disrespectful to our country as kneeling. Sorry. See, the NFL, this is their problem. And they created this by, at those meetings they just had, saying, okay, you've got to stand or we're going to fine the team. Or you can stay in the locker room. They're taking their cues from the White House in a way. I mean, they certainly do align themselves with what the president said. I think this is a problem they didn't need to fix because I don't think it was really that big of a problem at the end of the season. But oh no, they had to jump in front of it. So the NFL said, you can go in the locker room or you have to stand outside. And here is the president saying, no, actually staying in the locker room is just as bad as kneeling for the national anthem outside. Huh. Okay. Hi, John. I couldn't agree more about the teams going to the White House. Who cares? Just do your job, says Donald. From 312, John, maybe somebody should just keep his big mouth shut. A football guy told fans to Google any player and find out how they give back to their communities. That's an interesting point. I mean, really, if we do want to sort of assess the community involvement of these people, maybe we shouldn't judge them by whether or not they're standing on the sideline for a football game. John, I was born and raised in a very right Republican home. I've always considered myself a Republican and voted Republican. That being said, with the current administration, I question what I am anymore. From 630, these teams aren't America's teams. They're the products of their individual parades, minus Olympic teams. The teams should not have to visit the White House. That's interesting. I mean, that is a good point, isn't it? That's the Philadelphia team. It's not America's team. So if you were going to start to prioritize who goes to the White House, I would say somebody that wins an Olympic gold medal. Yeah. Great. If they, well, you know, here again, you might run into the same problem. But better they go to City Hall in Philadelphia than to the Capitol. And the list goes on. From 951, Dan Hampton did not attend the 85 Bears reunion at the Obama White House. Yeah, I think Hampton actually, did he introduce President Trump at an event? I know that he's on Team Trump. As of today, John, I'm not standing for the national anthem. No one tells us what, when, and where we have to stand. John, on Good Morning America this morning, they said that not one Eagle player ever took a knee on the field. Seems like he should not have rescinded the invite. It would have been bad because normally you have those giant backdrops, you know, of football players and coaches and trainers and team physicians. There's 8,500 people back there. And in this case, there'd be a dozen people back there.
Well, that's the problem. He's insulted.
That's it. Because when he says, unfortunately, only a small number of players decided. I was thinking about that word, unfortunately, Violetta. Unfortunately for whom?
For the president who has big crowds.
I know. This would be the smallest crowd, not the biggest crowd ever. This would be the smallest pro sports franchise to ever accommodate a president. It's not unfortunate. The players who don't want to go, don't want to go. The players who do want to go, go. So there's no unfortunate or fortunate about that. It is what it is. The only person for whom it's unfortunate is the person who's embarrassed that they didn't get a sort of a command performance, a big crowd. We've been doing commercials for the Tribune and their Lit Fest. It's an annual affair in Chicago, of course, that brings authors and writers of all stripe, newspaper writers, magazine writers, and authors to Chicago. And they do a whole series of seminars and book reviews and book sales and talk sessions. And a lot of the authors come into town. Joyce Carol Oates is in town. Is it tonight, Ella, for... No, she was going to be on with us today, but we couldn't work it out with the baseball game. But Joyce Carol Oates and others are coming to town. And then some of them are from Chicago. Robert Curson yesterday was nice to have him in studio. And Russ Bradbird is in our studio right now. All the dreams we've dreamed is his story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. Welcome to the show.
Good, John. It's good to be here. Thank you.
So where do you live these days?
Well, I teach at New Mexico State University, but I grew up on the edge of Albany Park, went to Von Steuben High School and North Park College. But I live in the summers, I live in Ravenswood. Right off the Brown Line. So I get out of the Chicago winters and the New Mexico summers. So it's a good, I'm not a millionaire, but it's a millionaire's lifestyle.
Ravenswood's a nice neighborhood.
That's right. A little different than the West Side.
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about your book. You and I were talking off the air and I said, I've spent a long time in the Chicago and area and in Illinois, but I haven't been in the gyms of Marshall and King. Yeah. And it's nice that you take me there.
Yes.
I really feel like I kind of wondered what life is like for these kids and what the basketball culture is in some of these city schools. And I really got a sense of that reading your book.
Yeah, I think any writer worth his salt is trying to take the reader into a world that they don't know. And of course, the danger is there's people who know this world a little better than I do that might not think I got it right. But I think I got Sean Harrington's story right and tried to get it right from my perspective.
Who is Sean Harrington?
Sean Harrington is at the center of the book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed. He was the assistant coach at Marshall, and almost exactly 4 years ago, he was driving his daughter to school at 7:30 in the morning, and he was in a rental car. And suddenly, two men ran up to the car and started shooting. And it was a mistaken identity, wrong car, wrong guy. But he dove on top of his daughter, John, and it's really an astonishing act of heroism. He dives on top of his daughter and takes two bullets in the back, one in the spine, but another bullet went through his daughter's headrest. So he undoubtedly saved her life. And the police were saying that right from the minute they showed up at the crime scene.
But
since then, he was paralyzed from the waist down. And he says, you know, that this is he did what any parent would have done. But I don't believe it. I think that we don't know how we're going to react till the bullets start flying. And he reacted like a hero. And so that's the sort of the central event of the book. And that's how the book starts out.
You describe how brazen the act was to these, what was it, two cars that were sort of going on either side. You're right, he was in a rental, and so the bad guys evidently thought that this was the car they were looking for, but it wasn't.
That's right.
And they, what did they get out of the cars and point and then just start firing?
Well, they were on the street already looking for someone that they had a disagreement with. But the terrifying thing to me at first was that it's still terrifying that it's 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, we always tell people, you don't shouldn't be out at 2 in the morning, or why are you at a party at 3 in the morning? But in this case, it's the morning commute.
So what happens to him as a result of these gunshots?
Well, because he was a special ed teacher's aide. He's not a regular teacher, and so he's under a different union contract. And so after 90 days, his paycheck stopped. And soon after that, his insurance stopped. And so I started.
He survived the shooting.
That's right.
Obviously.
He survived the shooting, as did the daughter, who's now a college sophomore. But I started trying to advocate for Sean. I had this idea that if I can get just as much publicity as I can get for Sean Harrington, that will help with the fundraising efforts now that his insurance has been cut off. But the more I tried to get publicity for him, the more I got obsessed with it. And finally, the writer Alex Kotlowitz, who wrote There Are No Children Here, really a great Chicago book, said, you know, I was trying to get him to write an article about it. And Alex said, you should write, this is a book you should be writing. And I thought, I think I had been in denial. I knew that I should be writing about it. But finally, after a year of advocating, I decided to start writing.
Where is he today?
Well, he was out of work for about 3 years until finally the Chicago Public Schools was able to repurpose his job. You know, there's no wheelchair. It's not wheelchair accessible at Marshall. And he wanted to stay at Marshall. Marshall is home for him. That's where Sean Harrington went to high school. He appeared briefly in the movie Hoop Dreams. But it's not wheelchair accessible. Well, they've created a new position for Sean at Marshall. He's a restorative justice counselor. So he's working with kids who have been damaged by violence or have a disagreement or that kind of thing. And so he's the intermediary. And it's actually the perfect job for him. Now, one of the things that I think has frustrated some of us is that he's not all of a sudden better because he got his job repurposed. So he's had ups and downs since then. You know, he's had been in and out of therapy trying to get 100% healthy, but he's planning on going back full time in the fall.
How much mobility does he have?
Well, he's good from the waist up. So he's a T4 spinal cord injury. So he's got full use of his arms, and you know everything above the waist is fine. And occasionally he'll get a little sparks of a little nerve connection, and his foot will kick or his leg will twitch or that kind of thing. And so I think he's still holding out hope that you know spinal cord injuries are funny. But my understanding is if he doesn't get better quickly and right away, that you know that hope starts fading, the percentages start fading. Yet with modern technology, you never know. So he's remarkably upbeat, but it's, you know, he's been through the and since his shooting, John, 7 Marshall players have been killed. Now 6 of them are in the book. Another one was killed 2 weeks ago.
Say that again?
Well, seven players that Sean had coached at Marshall High School, or six players that he'd coached at Marshall, have been killed.
How long was he a coach at Marshall High School?
Well, from 2008 until 2014, until the shooting.
Over the course of 6 years, they were averaging one player killed a year?
Yes, but all the players that were killed after Sean was shot. And so that's one of the things that happens in the book is that, you know, a writer named Grace Paley said, you don't really have a story till you have two stories. And in Sean's case, a year after he was shot, the star player of the team, a kid named Tim Triplett, was murdered. And that's when the story, I think, really took off for me in writing it. Is here was, you know, Tim Triplett and Sean Harrington were very similar. They both had a parent who had been murdered, victim of gun violence. They were both charismatic point guards. But Sean was able to get out of town, attend a junior college, and Tim Triplett, because Sean was incapacitated, was never able to find an out-of-town junior college scholarship, wound up staying in Chicago and was dead a year later.
You need to just dwell on this point a little longer. So in what span of time?
Well,
to think about this. If one basketball player from a lot of other schools had ever been shot,
that's right.
That would have been a story we talk about forever.
Well, I think that's very true. Is that, and even what Sean did in saving the daughter's life, had that happened overseas, you know, in a war zone or something, he'd be on the front of the New York Times. But I think because it's the West Side of Chicago, we've all become immune to the violence. But Sean was shot in 2014. And within 3 years, six other players had been murdered. And they were all from a 2 or 3 year time span. Triplett was really the only one you could call a star.
Were these murders connected?
No, not at all.
How endemic the violence is there?
Yes. And it's hard to say, you know, were the kids doing things at night that maybe they shouldn't have been doing? It's hard to say. It's murky. You know, some of the kids had minor arrest records. But you know, one of the things I think that's happened to, you know, that happened.
One of them was a drug dealer.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. But some of them, a couple of them, were clearly mistaken identity shootings. One of them, you know, a couple of them were kids who'd never been in trouble for anything, but other ones had been involved in the trade, it seemed. And so, one of the things that I struggle with in the book is, are we going to call a kid a gang member who's been arrested for marijuana? You know, and it's one of the I think difficult kids for kids growing up on the West Side is they often have arrest records for possession of marijuana.
You say that the culture on the south and west sides of Chicago is that if you're a basketball player, the code is if that kid keeps his nose clean and out of your business, the gangs don't pick on them. They're okay.
I think that was the code at one time, although there's certainly examples. You know, Ben Wilson, that everyone in Chicago would remember, was, you know, killed in broad daylight. He was the number one high school player in the country. But in general, the ball players were sort of given a pass. Some people call it, I know Bryant Gumbel on his HBO special on Sean Harrington called it the Hooper's pass. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But even Arthur Agee in the movie Hoop Dreams, you know, he gets at the end of the film, he was robbed at gunpoint. And so I think in general that was true. And there's less structure and less hierarchy now for a number of reasons.
It works both ways, too. You also describe a scene where Sean was with his friends and the cops pulled up and dragged him out of his Ford Bronco or whatever it was. He had a baggie. Can you tell that story?
Well, Sean has had, like a lot of kids on the West Side, he'd had a couple run-ins with the police where they wound up with their hands on the side of the car. And some of the other guys were complaining, saying, you know, raising hell. And Sean said, you know, he's pretty unflappable. I said, look, fellas, let's just let them do their job and we'll get out of here.
Even though in this instance, there was no crime that they had committed.
No, and it was a mixed race crew with some Puerto Rican kids and African American kids. But Sean has been, you know, he's remarkably resilient. And one time he'd been picked up on another occasion, wound up in the back of a squad car, and then just was let go. But his feeling, he doesn't harbor bitterness in a way that, you know, that's one of the interesting things about the book, John, is he has a different view of a lot of the things that happened than I do. He has this idea that he didn't do anything heroic, which I don't think is true, but he has this, you know, he was remarkably receptive to, you know, letting the cops do their job and that kind of thing.
Well, was that the episode where, so he's got his hands cuffed behind his back, he's going to maybe the police station for reasons that aren't clear to him, or it's clear to him that this is wrong. There's no law against having a baggie that's empty. And then he starts to engage them and talk about basketball. What do you make of the Bulls this season?
Yes, they were complaining about the Bulls' offense since
he starts Michael to speak up.
Yes, and they said, well, what do you know about it? And you know, I think that's one of the amazing things about Sean Harrington is he's able to, what some people call switching codes, that he can talk to the high school principal, he can talk to the gangbanger kid, he can talk to the president of the Chicago Tribune Corporation. He can talk to a lot of different people and switch codes, and I think that's what's really remarkable about him.
Well, somebody in the book was talking about, was it his principal, how valuable a guy like him, and he particularly, specifically was to that school. To the administrators, he could dress immaculately, he could speak the professional grade speech, but then when he was in the hallways or on the court with the kids, he could relate to them on their level. And for a male to have that kind of a role in these kids' lives at school was so important.
I think that's very true, is that there's less male teachers than you might think. And especially to have, the big celebrity, at a lot of the West Side schools, particularly, are the basketball stars and the basketball coaches. And so to have a coach that could talk to every kid, knew every kid by name, and had this sort of magical touch with kids was really invaluable to Marshall.
And Marshall's always been kind of a hard-scrabble team, right? Never the biggest school, never the biggest kids, but always the swarming defense, the high energy club. Is that a fair description?
That's right. And I think that's part of the reason, at the beginning of all the dreams we've dreamed, I talk about that, is that Sean reacted like a war hero when the bullets started flying, partly because he'd grown up around gun violence. But also, I think, you play for Luther Bedford, the legendary Marshall coach, and you're sort of taught, like, no matter how under fire we are, we're not going to panic. We're going to react calmly and coolly and do what we're supposed to do, and that's how he reacted.
Luther Bedford, the one that would whack the kids when they got bad grades?
Well, yes, and the movie, the Hoop Dreams, doesn't cover that, but it was just a different mentality in a different era.
Well, it wasn't 1932 this happened, though.
No, but if everyone I interviewed for the book all said, yes, I was paddled by Luther Bedford if I got an F or a D or if I missed class, and I'm glad he did it. It's not what you would expect from the civil rights activists or that kind of thing.
Or the kids themselves.
That's right.
So it was, what, six whacks for an F and three for a D?
Something like that. And, so Sean was a pretty good student, so he had a minimum of Fs.
But you tell the story about the one kid who'd flunked off the team his senior year. So
yes.
He's not coming back next year, and he's not going to play basketball again.
Right.
So he turns in his report card. He's got all Fs.
Yes.
He goes into the coach, and he knows he's now going to get hit six times, plus some extra because the coach was angry. He's going to get 30, 40, 50 whacks.
Why not walk out?
You ain't coming back next year, dude. You're a senior.
Well, I think it has to do with, there's a certain mentality, I think, that the Marshall kids have, and Sean Harrington certainly has it, that the book talks about, is that these guys, they're the Marshall Commandos, which is one of the great nicknames ever. But whenever they send an email or text, they always put at the end of it, C4L, Commandos for life. And I think, my hunch on this is that kid who had to get the 18 whacks and could have walked out, never gotten whacked, but he would never play it again anyway. I think he felt like, I'm still a commando, even though I'm kicked off the team.
I've got to
react like a commando.
Man alive. Russ Bradford's book is All the Dreams We've Dreamed. I got to go, Russ, but this is more than just a story about basketball or one basketball player / coach / school administrator now. It's a story about part of Chicago that some of us know about, but only tangentially. We only read a little bit about it, and you take us into that.
Thank you. That's right. And we'll be at Printer's Row on Saturday at 1 p.m. at Jones High School Library, but also at City Lit Books Wednesday night, City Lit Books at 6:30, if you can't get to Printer's Row this weekend.
If you can't, just find it. All the Dreams We've Dreamed. Well done, Russ. Nice to meet you.
Thank you, John.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Whatever.
Here's John Williams.
It's complicated. This is John. It's 2:07 on WGN. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio for about 20 more minutes. We've got pregame coverage of White Sox baseball. They dropped the puck at 3:10 this afternoon on WGN. On social media, you can find me at WGN King John. I want to be king someday, but the paperwork is tied up in Cook County. By the way, do you know a wow neighbor? Somebody who's such a great neighbor? Maybe somebody who volunteers so much in the community, you just want to say, wow, what a great guy or gal? I want you to nominate a neighbor you want us to recognize here on WGN Radio by going to WGNradio.com/contests. The application's on our contest page. It's not really a contest. Maybe it is. It's an opportunity opportunity for you to nominate somebody, and each week we'll choose somebody. It's kind of new for us here, and I think this is a great idea. Tell us what that great person is all about. What about them, in 100 words or less, you think makes them a wow neighbor? Your neighbor could win the ultimate detail package for their car from Bill Jacobs BMW in Naperville and be congratulated by us on the radio. Again, nominate him or her at WGNradio.com/contest. It's sponsored by WOW, Internet, TV, and Phone. It's 208. Steve, are you still over there in the newsroom? We're in different buildings. We've moved and communication isn't the best these days. But I just want to make sure I'm clear on where we are on the all-important NFL saga. I'm reading from a headline in Fox News 5, San Diego, Trump to NFL players, patriotism is my way or the highway. And they also say he's tweeting, we will proudly be playing the national anthem and other wonderful music celebrating our country at 3 p.m. the White House with the United States Marine Band and the United States Army Chorus honoring America! Exclamation point. So he's going to go on with his patriotic party, whether the Philadelphia Eagles want to be part of it or not. At least that's my understanding of where the story is. Now, let's talk to Patrick Hanan a little bit about this. His book is West Winging It. Pat, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing well.
So you're, let's not dwell on this, but since I just brought it up, you had a number of roles in the White House starting at intern. What would you say was the job you had for the longest period of time in the White House?
I had two that were about the same length. One was called Press Wrangler, in which I was responsible for literally wrangling the press. So wherever the president went, be it, you know, a basketball game or to across the country and around the world or to Russia or wherever, I was with him and I was sort of making sure the press was with him and that they had everything they needed. And then I did that for about 2 years. And then I finished up my time there as a writer and a deputy director of messaging. And I did that for about 2 years too. So I split my time writing for the president and then also helping to plan out how we used his time, where we sent him, who we talked to, stuff like that.
Your book's really fun, West Winging It. So people in that Wrangler position in the White House today probably had the media getting ready for this event, and then it blows up. I wonder what that would have been like for you, or what is it like for your colleagues there today?
Right. Well, what's interesting is those were always some of the craziest days when the sports teams would come because, you know, they're, and by the way, I'm from Philadelphia, so I'm a huge Eagles fan. So this would have been a big day for me in the Obama White House, something I couldn't have imagined. But yeah, it's just sort of it's insane what's going on there with this whole story. And I think a lot of people were probably shocked, not ultimately surprised, given the way the president likes to gin up this sort of noise, especially with the NFL and the NFL players who are, in some cases, advocating for criminal justice reform and however that manifests itself. It's interesting to note the Eagles, none of them even kneeled this entire season. So for the president to pretend that they did is a little disingenuous.
I suggested earlier today that maybe what we ought to do is just stop the parade, the literal and the figurative parade to the White House for the winning teams each year. Let's just, you know, some people didn't want to go to Barack Obama's events either. Let's just not right. make it so complicated. What do you think of that?
I still think that with a more, and I'm obviously a biased Democrat, but I think even with a more normal Republican White House, it's still a fun event and it's a nice tradition. But I do think that while President Trump is there, he seems to be using the event in a very divisive way. And a much more than normal number of players don't want to be associated with him or his White House. So, yeah, it's sort of it's a little bit of a sad note to go out of each season on. And, you know, you've already seen LeBron James and Steph Curry say that whoever wins this next series, they're not going to go to the White House either. So I think for during the Trump era, it might be wise to just cancel these.
Well, you're a real smart fella. You get to the White House and everybody's talking about what the POTUS is doing, POTUS. I think a lot of people know that acronym stands for President of the United States. When did you discover that fact, Pat?
So I had a pretty inauspicious start to my time at the White House. It was my very first day, and I was trying to prove my worth to my coworkers. And I remember vividly during the afternoon, in sort of a quiet lull, I turned to one of my coworkers, and you know, I'd heard this term thrown around so much, and I just said, "Hey, what's a POTUS?" And the room just went silent, and I knew, wow, I'm pretty out of my depth here. Somehow they went. They let me stay for the next 6.5 years, so I feel very lucky.
Yeah, you had a number of, sort of knuckleheaded moments like that, which I think all of us can relate to. And obviously, you're quite an accomplished person, too. But one of the nice takeaways is that all of us have those moments and we can survive it, even when you're working for the President of the United States. You can't get past
exactly.
Something like that. And kind of leads me to this point. I mean, so we talk about some of the, you know, incredible things that we're witnessing with a White House today that's draining the swamp and changing all of the norms. And then you look back to what it was like when Mitt Romney and Barack Obama were running against each other for the presidency. And Mitt Romney said 47% of these people I don't care about because they're never going to vote for me anyway. That 1,000 years ago when Mitt Romney was running was seen as an incredible gaffe that would need to be managed.
Yep.
And on the same page, as you remind us of a time when Barack Obama said about somebody who had accomplished something, "You didn't do this alone." And what he meant was, you know, it sort of takes a village. It takes all of us working together to lift everybody up, yada, yada, yada. But that was seen as an incredibly boneheaded thing to say. Those seem so mild by the sort of incendiary comments we're used to today, don't they?
It really does. Those were the two defining gaffes of the 2012 election. And I was lucky. I was a Wrangler at that time, so I was on the road with the president every single day. And that's part of the reason I wanted to write this book, because, you know, that seems like a million years ago. But the truth is, that was just a few years ago. So I wanted to sort of capture what was a very different time, but what was a time that I'm hopeful that we can potentially get back to, on the Republican and Democratic side after the Trump era ends. But it was certainly, those gaps wouldn't have even registered today.
Yeah. You tell us the story in your book, West Winging It. Pat Canan's on the phone line, a writer for and wrangler for the Obama administration for 6 years. He started out as an intern and then left when the administration left. You tell us the story about when the Obamas went to Senegal and the point from which the slaves would depart Africa and head for the United States. So here is this black first couple visiting that place. Talk a little bit about what that moment was like and how the press interacted with that and what you thought about that.
Right. That was, again, while I was a wrangler. And we were in Senegal at what was called the Door of No Return, where all these slaves or folks who were actually, unfortunately, being sent off to America as slaves, it would have been where they were sent off from. And I just vividly remember the president briefly inhabiting what would have been their vantage point, coming through this door of no return. And meanwhile, I'm out about 40 yards out on this boat, rocking and rolling in the ocean with 13 members of the press snapping pictures and taking notes. And, you know, in the moment, I thought, this is just so... This is awkward and disrespectful, and this is a moment for this president, and we should have kept it private for him. But then as I sort of reflected back on it, and I really wanted to make this point in the book, that no, it was actually, it wasn't just for the president. It was a bigger moment, and it was crucial that the press be there to capture that moment of the president who had sort of, you know, a person who looked like him hundreds of years ago would have been sent off on those boats too, and to show the world the progress that we've made. So it was really a point about how important the press is. And I tried to make that, it's natural to have sort of a push and pull between the White House and the press, and we certainly had a healthy tension in the Obama White House. But I did want to make a point in the book that the press is far from what Donald Trump says. They're not the enemies of the American people. They play an absolutely crucial role at the White House.
Talk about Barack Obama having to be the counselor in chief, the healer in chief of the Sandy Hook shootings and what that was like for you all.
Right. Those were the White House was this unique environment in the sense that any day could change on a dime. And you never knew what you were going to get when you walked through the doors. And I'll never forget, in December, after the election when news started to break of a shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. And the day just changed, and the joy of the holiday season just got sucked out of the White House in an instant. And then we went up there a couple of days later. I was a Wrangler at that time, too, and I was, you know, with him when he was delivering this speech in this auditorium, you know, a high school auditorium like you've been in a million times, but it was just so different with all the family and friends of these little kids who were killed. And so it was just another moment where the president had to put on this hat that he wore, had to wear way too often, which was, you know, consoler in chief. And he said this publicly, I believe, that, you know, the inaction on common sense gun reform in the wake of these shootings was his biggest frustration as president. And I think that was pretty apparent to the American public when I think, you know, he even let his emotion show. He's known as sort of, you know, people call him sort of Spock-like because he doesn't show a lot of emotion. But in those moments, he let America in to see how this affected him. And he, I think, was shocked that Congress still wouldn't move.
Well, as a person who helped Obama craft his messaging, what do you make of the decision to turn that into just a moment of grief and reconciliation or a moment of action? One way to characterize that is politicizing that event. What do you make of that dilemma for you all?
It's absolutely a dilemma, but you know, again, I'm an Obama guy, so I'm biased, but I really appreciated the way the president handled those situations, which is to say, he started off, you know, by eulogizing the people who were killed, and he did it respectfully. And he said, you know, he made a point always to say the names of the people who were killed to really humanize this tragedy and make people sort of empathize with it. But he also realized that America's eyes are really only opened in the immediate wake of these horrors. So, you know, you've got a day or two to make an important point. And to me, it's not politicizing it. It's trying to take action to combat it. And I was always proud of the way the president did that,
even though
it ultimately proved ineffective.
I was reading what he said. How much of Barack Obama's words that I remember, State of the Union addresses, Sandy Hook speeches, et cetera, how much of those did he write himself? How much of them were collaborative? Can you talk about that? And also talk about this, House of Cards versus Veep. What's a better description of what the White House is like? Pat Kanan's on a phone line, and he'll be appearing at the Lit Fest in Chicago this week. His book is West Winging It, an unpresidential memoir. House of Cards or Veep? Who wrote Obama's words? Coming up, we're talking to Pat Kanan. His book is West Winging It. He's going to be appearing at Lit Fest, talking about his days as a presidential aide, both as a wrangler, as an intern, as a messaging expert and writer. And Pat, just before the break, I asked you how much of the writing that I know Barack Obama for, the words, did he write or was he writing himself?
Right. So, you know, his biggest speeches, his States of the Union and his speeches, you know, like we talked about in Newtown at Sandy Hook, those were speeches that he was quite involved with. So he would have dealt with the chief speechwriters on those. So it was Jon Favreau and Cody Keenan. And I believe the way the process worked, he would call them into the Oval, and he'd sort of sketch out what he wanted the speech to be. They'd go off and write it, and it'd be quite collaborative between those two. But the truth is the president had to deliver, you know, thousands of speeches during his time as president, and we sent out tons of statements in his voice. So he was really quite involved in the ones that you would remember because they were the important speeches. But he had a team of folks to try to get his voice down for the lesser speeches and statements that he also had to give.
Were you guys tweeting a lot? I don't remember now. Did Barack Obama tweet much?
Towards the end of our time in the White House, we brought on a guy named Jason Goldman, who was sort of one of the on the founding team at Twitter, and we had an Office of Digital Strategy. So we had sort of a plan for how to communicate via social media. But it was a little bit, different than the way the current White House.
But I wonder if your administration were 8 years later, you'd probably be more involved in Twitter. What do you make of this president's ability to cut right to people with his phone?
First of all, you're right. You know, we evolved with social media as social media evolved. So Twitter would only become more and more important, I suppose. You know, I think it's effective for him. I think it's irresponsible the way he uses it, but it's certainly he's getting the points he wants to get across, even though I think they're kind of weird points.
I got 45 seconds. Veep or what was the other one? House of Cards.
House of Cards. So I'm a TV writer now, so I have strong feelings on this. The most accurate show for the way it really is in the White House is Veep.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, but because because the other one is kind of crazy anyway, but is Veep a fair representation of the chaos and the comedy of a White House?
I would say that Veep nails the minutia of a White House. They really get at the heart of sort of the way a small thing can spiral. I like to say that the Obama White House was sort of a nice mixture of Veep and the West Wing. So it was a lot of minutia, but then there were also some moments of awe. And that's sort of also the way what I wanted to do with my book, West Wing. It was a lot about the day to day and the funniness, but then also punctuated by these moments of awe and reminders that you're working at the White House.
It's very, very fly on the wall. Has it been optioned?
Yeah. We're working on developing an app for television. Should have a fun announcement soon.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think it's a movie as much as it's a TV show. I guess it could be both, huh?
Right.
Pat, great. Congratulations.
And we
look forward to seeing you in Chicago at LitFest, West Winging It.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
An unpresidential memoir by Pat Canaan. Thanks, Pat.